From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 9th, 2015. And on this day, Mainers, especially women, are flocking to gun stores in anticipation of the state's new concealed carry law, scheduled to go into effect next week. The Penobscot County Jail is bursting at the seams with inmates, and jail administrators say it's not just a lack of money that's to blame. And how Washington politics threatens funding for Maine's roads, bridges, and airports. That and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. The state's new concealed carry law will not become effective until October 15th, but hundreds of Mainers are already preparing for the day by purchasing handguns and holsters and enrolling in firearm safety courses. Gun shops are reporting steady to moderate upticks in sales, especially among women. A.J. Higgins reports.
Few bills have sprinted through the legislative process like Maine's Concealed Carry or Constitutional Carry Initiative that will now allow any Mainer who is not otherwise prohibited from owning a firearm to carry a loaded weapon on their person or in their car. Embraced by more than 100 bipartisan co-sponsors and Governor Paul LePage, the bill becomes the law of the land on October 15th.
Well, since that's happened, we've seen a large group of Mainers coming in looking to purchase firearms. A lot of them are small firearms that they're looking to utilize when the law is passed and in effect.
Ryan Nyer is vice president of Maine Military Supply in Holden.
We've also seen holsters being a huge uptick. A lot of customers already have handguns, and they're coming in looking for a way to actually carry that firearm on them concealed.
Across the Penobscot River in Herman, James Collins of the Trident Armory is also reporting increased interest from customers since the law was passed, including couples.
That's husband and wife combinations. Generally, what we're finding is that you have one spouse who already has a carry permit and carries, and the other spouse is starting to display interest in that and getting a little bit more, you know, interested in learning how to carry a firearm.
Both gun shops say they're seeing more women showing interest in firearms. In fact, there's been so much interest, Nyer set aside one day of the week to focus on that clientele.
Wednesdays is Ladies' Day in our indoor shooting range. The ladies come in, they don't have to pay anything to get in there, and they can try out firearms in our indoor shooting range. So we recognize that ladies and couples together are coming in really interested in the industry and looking for some way to carry.
I have a Glock 40, and I have a 22 Magnum, and then I have a 380.
Crystal Boone of Lincoln says she's had some familiarity with firearms and decided to sign up for a training course at Trident Armory. She says the instruction has greatly improved her level of confidence and sense of comfort in using a handgun, and that the idea of concealed carry is going to quickly catch on among single women concerned about personal safety.
I personally know at least five other women that are interested in taking this course so that they can get confident with their guns. And that's to me, that's why a lot of women don't carry, is because they're not confident. And I feel like there's going to be a lot more people doing it because of the concealed carry law coming up.
Although Maine's new law requires gun buyers to accept a firearm safety brochure, it does not mandate any training. Trident's James Collins says many gun buyers in Maine are already well-versed in safety.
A lot of kids in Maine are learning to shoot guns at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and they're being trusted to carry a loaded firearm in the woods to hunt with at the age of 8 to 10 years old. And because of that, there are a lot of exceptions to what a lot of non-gun owners and gun aficionados think is the rule.
While the bill made it quickly through the legislature, there were unsuccessful efforts to amend it to require a firearm safety course. That failure disappointed Emma Connor. She's the director of the Maine Gun Safety Coalition, which supports a question on next year's ballot that would require federal background checks on gun sales in Maine.
We require people to get a driver's license and take driver's ed before they can drive a car. This new law will make it possible for people who've never had any kind of gun safety training to carry a concealed weapon in public.
Democratic State Senator Stan Grzowski of Brunswick sponsored one of the failed amendments. He says he wouldn't be surprised to see a bill seeking a training requirement go before lawmakers next year. The new law, meanwhile, is expected to save the state about $160,000 a year in costs related to the concealed weapons permitting through the Maine State Police. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
State health officials say tests confirm that two toddlers infected with E. coli likely acquired the bacteria from the same source. One boy died from the infection on Monday, and the other child is in fair condition at Maine Medical Center. State epidemiologist Dr. Siri Bennett says testing confirms that the two children were infected with an identical strain of the bacteria. A common link, she says, is that they both visited the petting zoo at the Oxford County Fair.
The Department of Agriculture took some samples from the Oxford County Fairground. Those are currently being tested, but we won't have the results until late next week.
Officials say the best ways to prevent E. coli infections are to wash hands after interacting with animals, cook beef thoroughly, and avoid drinking unpasteurized milk. In recent weeks, Maine's struggling county jails began receiving just over $12 million in financial relief from the state. But sheriffs say the payout falls short of what they need to cope with rising operational costs and the extra expenses associated with overcrowding. The overcrowding has become especially bad at the Penobscot County Jail. Jay Field talked with law enforcement prosecutors and defense attorneys in Bangor about the problem and what, aside from more state money, can be done to combat it.
So today we're 197. The in-house capacity is supposed to be 157.
The overcrowding is so bad that Penobscot County Sheriff Troy Morton has inmates sleeping on cots all over the jailhouse.
What used to be classrooms or programming rooms had to be turned into housing.
The jail actually has 100 more inmates than it can handle today. Morton says the sheriff's department is paying to board an additional 60 at jails in nearby counties with more space. Inside the Penobscot facility, Morton says the environment is tense.
It does increase the amount of altercations that we've had. We had two assaults this past week that were inmate on inmate.
Morton won't give me a tour or allow me to take photos of the jail or the control room due to the chaos. Ask Morton how to ease some of the tension, and he's quick to bring up money. Over the summer, a law was passed to provide the jails just over $12 million, about 15% of their overall yearly budget.
This has been the first time in many years that we actually have received our funding from the state. We actually have the money and know how much they're going to pay us, not a guess.
The problem, though, is that the Penobscot County Jail is still more than $400,000 in the hole from last year. Morton says sheriffs are likely to ask the legislature for more money next year. But when I ask what can be done in the near term to ease the overcrowding, Morton mentions a survey of the jail's inmates taken last weekend by his deputies,
which drilled down into our pretrial population. 67% of those incarcerated in our facility were pretrial. Of that 67%, 46% had no bail at all. We're greatly impacted by the courts.
Every month, Morton and his deputies provide the Penobscot County Superior Court with a list of inmates and how long each has been locked up. Over at the courthouse, there are different views on what's causing overcrowding at the jail and what should be done to ease it. Jeffrey Silverstein, a longtime defense attorney, says more and more nonviolent offenders are being subjected to bail conditions that can't be met.
Some of this is caused by repeat criminality due to addiction, where the people aren't necessarily getting arrested for heavy drugs involvement, but they're getting arrested for petty crime, stuff to support habits.
Silverstein gives the hypothetical example of someone with a drug addiction. They get high, steal from, or get into an altercation with a neighbor, and are charged with petty theft or maybe criminal trespassing.
You know, they're subject to bail conditions, no use of possession, subject to random search and testing. So officers just show up at will. And if they find that the person has beer in the fridge or had been drinking a beer or what have you, you know, that's cause for arrest.
Silverstein says these kinds of offenders shouldn't be clogging up the county jails. The Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution prohibits courts from setting unreasonably high bails. But Maine's bail code states the public needs to be protected from potential criminality. And Chris Almy says that's a sound standard that needs to continue. Almy is Penobscot County District Attorney.
I don't think it's appropriate to just say, well, the jails are crowded, therefore we're going to let people out who are accused of robbery or some serious offenses. Just let them out because the jails are crowded.
Almy says the court needs to do a better job identifying defendants who are languishing in jail, either pending trial or sentencing.
The judges need to sit down with the prosecutors and identify those prisoners in jail that should have their cases set for sentencing or set for trial and get them done.
But too often, says Almy, judges and prosecutors get buried under the day-to-day workload and don't do the kind of advanced planning that could move cases along more quickly. So many defendants sit in Penobscot County Jail for months, even though they're ready to be tried or sentenced and moved to a state correctional facility. For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
The former head of a Midcoast charity who embezzled more than $4 million from the organization has been sentenced to 4 years in federal prison, the Bangor Daily News reports. Rusty Brace headed United Midcoast Charities in Camden for 17 years. His scheme came to light in the fall of 2014 when the new CEO asked a board member and frequent donor for a contribution. The donor told Crane he'd just written the charity a check for $35,000, but UMCC had no record of the donation. Crane says he later learned that Brace had deposited the check and many others over the years into a private bank account for his own use. A former insurance broker from Scarborough today pleaded guilty to securities fraud, forgery, and theft and other charges after state regulators say he misled his client regarding her retirement savings. Judith Shaw of the Maine Office of Securities says Thomas Skypeck persuaded his client to authorize a number of needless transactions, a practice known as churning.
A situation where you may have a financial professional who convinces you to do transactions that are unnecessary, essentially just because it's going to generate a commission for the insurance professional.
Shaw says Skypeck told his client to withdraw nearly $60,000 to purchase silver coins, some of which he then sold for his own gain. Down in Washington today, 10 members of the U.S. House from states that had crew members aboard the cargo ship El Faro stood in silence in the well of the U.S. House of Representatives. First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree acknowledged the four Mainers who were lost when the ship went down last week in Hurricane Joaquin.
In Maine, we have a strong connection to those who make their living on the water, and we know the risks they take every time they go to sea. But in no way does that make a tragedy any less painful.
Pingree thanked the Coast Guard, Navy, and Air Force for their around-the-clock efforts to find the crew under often treacherous conditions. Congress this week handed President Obama a huge defense spending bill. The $612 billion proposal includes a provision introduced by Maine delegates to boost job creation in the Pine Tree State. Tom Porter has more.
The Senate version of the bill passed this week includes a provision, authored by independent Maine Senator Angus King, to expand eligibility for the so-called Hub Zone program. It's designed to boost economic activity in communities where military bases have closed down, and King's provision is expected to positively impact the former Brunswick Naval Base in Maine. A similar amendment, written by Republican Maine Congressman Bruce Poliquin, was in the House version of the bill that was approved last week. Although the defense bill has passed both houses of Congress, however, it still faces the threat of a presidential veto. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
Meanwhile, federal transportation funds are scheduled to run out at the end of this month, when a fix agreed to in July expires. In Maine, nearly 40% of all spending on transportation infrastructure, including roads, bridges, and airports, comes from the federal government. As Mal Leary reports, to keep the funds flowing, another short-term fix might be required.
Last summer, after the House stood in the way of a three-year spending bill, Congress passed a short-term measure to fund transportation programs through October 29th. The Senate reluctantly went along. Maine Senator Angus King, an independent, is worried that the longer-term plan that most senators favor would be strongly opposed by fiscal conservatives because it would tax corporate profits now being held by overseas-based affiliates of U.S. corporations in order to pay for transportation funding over 3 years.
It would be denominated as a tax increase, I believe, by Grover Norquist and the anti-tax folks, so I think that's going to be very difficult.
Republican Senator Susan Collins says fuel taxes can no longer generate the revenues needed to pay for the repair and replacement of roads and bridges. She says while everybody recognizes the problem, it's been hard to come up with a solution that can win enough political support. She says if the House would agree to the three-year plan the Senate has adopted, it would provide time to build a consensus after a new president is in office.
At least the Senate bill gets us past the presidential election, and then perhaps we'll have, well, we'll definitely have new leadership, and maybe that will be the impetus that allows everyone to sit down and confront this problem.
First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, a Democrat, says she would support a gas tax increase and a six-year funding plan based on that tax hike. But she says there aren't enough votes in the House to pass that measure. With the resignation of House Speaker John Boehner, she says, House Republicans are not focused on issues.
The majority party is having leadership elections this week, so they seem to be somewhat in a state of flux. But hopefully after this week's elections, we'll get back to work and they will propose a plan for that because obviously we can't run out of highway funds.
But 2nd District Congressman Bruce Poliquin, a Republican, says he is hopeful for a long-term funding plan for 6 or 7 years.
There is growing interest here in that I can see in the House and in the Senate for a refunding of the Highway Trust Fund that funds our roads and bridges throughout the country.
State transportation officials have been waiting for a long-term plan. Right now, there is enough money in the pipeline for current road projects. But without new legislation, contracts will be limited to what can be paid for with state funds. And that points to a sharp cut in projects. For MPBN News, I'm Mal Leary.
And beginning Monday, you'll be able to bring your cat or small dog along on Amtrak trips. The rail service says it will now allow passengers on some Northeast routes to include their pets on trips up to 7 hours long. It'll cost an extra $25, and pets will have to be in carriers weighing no more than 20 pounds, including the pet. No newborn pets are allowed. They have to be at least 8 weeks old and have all their vaccinations. And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, October 9th, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to A.J. Higgins, Jay Field, Mal Leary, Patty White, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to know what you think about the program. You can let us know by emailing us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. Our news staff is off on Monday for the Columbus Day holiday. I'll be back here with you on Tuesday. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.